everyone. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Thursday, September 29th. I'm Amanda Borshel-Dan, here with our political correspondent Tal Schneider and environment reporter Sue Sirks. Hello to you both.
Hi, Amanda.
Good morning.
So good to see you. We are now a bit over a month to the November 1st elections. Tal has some updates here. And Sue will fill us in on new studies and give us some tips to make a less wasteful holiday season. Tal, let's start with you. Yesterday, we heard the news that the Central Elections Committee has disqualified former lawmaker and Yamina rebel Amichai Shikli from running on the Likud candidate slate. At the same time, though, fellow former Yamina rebel MK Idit Silman is able to retain her spot on the slate. So what is going on here?
Right, Amanda. Under Israeli law, if you leave your own faction during the Knesset time and turn against it, you are under scrutiny and you are under the risk of being disqualified. This is exactly what happened when Amichai Shikli decided more than a year ago to turn against his own faction, Yamina. As you remember, the Yamina was the party in which Naftali Bennett was the chairman and under which he became the prime minister. Yamina originally had 7 seats. Amichai Shikli was one of them, and immediately after the Knesset was sworn back in, I think, April 2021, immediately thereafter, he turned against it and he started to vote constantly against his own faction. He voted against them on budget. He voted against them on bills that were actually right-wing bills for unification law and so on. The reason for that was that the Likud voted against them no matter what, even if the bill was doing justice to Israel's right wing, or and so. He was just turning against them, and for that reason, he was declared a rebel. There is a formal definition under Israel basic law of a rebel of his own faction, and it was declared such. And because of that declaration, he could not join the Likud unless, Amanda, he would step down from the Knesset immediately after he was announced a rebel. He didn't do it. He stayed in the Knesset. And for that reason, the judge yesterday declared him unable to join the Likud party for the 25th Knesset. On the opposing end, his, you may call it, sister MK, Idit Silman, she was not a declared rebel. And for that reason, she can join the Likud after she stepped down from the Knesset. So, you know, the judge actually ruled, you know, one thing in favor for the Likud, another thing against the Likud. Yet the entire scene of the right-wing anchors, right-wing opinion leaders and so on, they are so furious with the judge. And this is the reason, I know it's a bit technical, but this is the reason I want to stress the point. The judge who is heading now the Central Election Committee, Itzhak Amit, is scheduled to become Israel's Supreme Court judge president next year. And right now, people from, I wouldn't say Likud MKs, but definitely kind of Likud opinion leaders and anchors and supporting, you know, group of media people who supports Netanyahu very strictly, they are already saying, we are going to take power in this election and make sure Itzhak Amit will not be the president of the Supreme Court of Israel. How can they do that? They will have to change the laws. But they say, you know, we're going to take power in November 1st, you know, form a government and definitely change those laws such that he will not become the president. And this is, you know, it's already causing a huge stir everywhere around, you know, Justice Minister Gideon Saar, who is running in the Machane Mamlachti. That's the party headed by Benny Gantz, used to be blue and white. Now they have a different name. Gideon Saar, who is the Justice Minister, is running in that list, came out this morning and in protection of this Supreme Court judge, who is now chairing the Central Committee. So a lot of chaos. You know, it's political, but it's also judicial. And it's making huge waves across the scene.
Okay, now another petition that's up for the Central Election Committee to decide upon today is to disqualify two Arab parties from the upcoming elections. That's, of course, Ra'am, which is headed by Mansour Abbas, and the nationalist Balad. What do you think the chances are that these petitions will be accepted and that these two parties will not be able to run?
Well, according to the past, every election we have a request to disqualify them. It's like having the sunrise at the east and sinking in the west. Every election, it's the same story. And every time the election committee, which is a political committee, disqualify them, and then they go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court puts them back in. Now, this time around, it may be that they will not get disqualified at the first level. And the reason for that is because the Likud and Yesh Atid, two big parties, have announced that they will not participate in the vote. Why the Likud will not participate in the vote, you ask yourself. They sure wants to see some Arab lawmakers out of the Knesset. The reason for that is because Balad, who is the smallest party of all, will probably not cross the threshold. And the Likud thinks, let them run, waste around 30,000 votes or even more, and this will change the entire, it will take off balance from the political map, from the way you distribute the mandates after the election. And it will give the right wing a better chances to go to the 61 seats they need so much. So they decided not to participate purely on political, reasoning, not because they think that Balad should run. As per Ra'am, this is the Islamic movement. Again, I think the people who are trying to suggest that they should be disqualified will have problem with their cases, because obviously the chairman of Ra'am, Mansour Abbas, was never even blamed or was never even investigated for anything. And definitely, they will have a problem to prove that. Let me also say that this is maybe the first time that those parties may be granted their ability to run, because the people who are submitting the request to disqualify them are not political party. This is NGOs coming from the outside trying to maneuver this process. And, Amanda, I think it will fail.
Okay, and we'll find out today, by the end of today.
Today or tomorrow, we'll see, depending on the judge's decision-making process.
Fabulous. We will definitely update. We'll go to a short break now.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Israel will be going back to the voting booths on November 1st. It is final. Back to the voting booths.
Welcome to Paralyzed Nation. This is Israel's fifth election in less than 4 years. But what are these elections actually about?
The politics of deadlock.
A face-off between populist identitarian politics and the effort to preserve Israel as a liberal democracy.
Small shifts at the margins.
I don't think we're going to have a solution. We're heading towards another deadlock.
The rise and the mainstreaming of what we might politely call the far right.
A referendum on Netanyahu.
I'm Amanda Borsell-Dan. Join me and our Times of Israel political analysts,
Chaviv Retigur,
Jeremy Sharon,
Carrie Keller-Lynn,
Tal Schneider,
David Horowitz,
as we drill down on these hard-to-answer questions in this limited edition podcast series that is exclusively for our Times of Israel community. Welcome to Paralyzed Nation. And we're back. Sue is here to discuss some really fascinating research that kind of straddles both of our worlds. She's going to talk about research out of Timna, which is the home to the quote-unquote famous King Solomon's copper mines. Definitely, arguably not King Solomon's mines, but it's known for that. So Sue, tell us about the research and how it is more environmental than archaeological in nature.
Well, Amanda, I know that you've written fascinating pieces about the discovery of ancient textiles in Timna. This is an environmental story with a message for today. And this time, the story concerns Tel Aviv University research, which has found that the ancients working at the famed copper mines cut down so many trees and bushes to make charcoal to fire the smelting pits for the copper, that they eventually caused the industry to close down and they caused the local environment to collapse. Now, what happened is that the researchers, they looked at slag heaps from the end of the 11th century BCE. These were mounds containing charcoal from those smelting ovens. And there was layer upon layer of this stuff, which gave them a chronological record. And they found that from the end of the 11th century BCE, that was their focus, they were mainly burning acacia and white broom. Acacia is a very important tree in the desert area. It's called a keystone species, which means that it not only helps to hold the ground together and prevent erosion, and it retains water. It also provides food for livestock and wild animals. Very, very important. And white broom is a beautiful bush that blooms in the spring in a flush of white. It's actually the herald of spring in the desert. And so they were basically digging up they weren't even taking branches. They were digging up the trees and the white broom, and they were definitely burning the roots of the white broom. And then evidently they ran out of acacia trees and white broom, and they had to go further and further afield. And this was revealed in the charcoal remains, which showed that as time passed, they were using trees like pistachio. They would have had to go a lot further for these. By the mid-9th century BCE, it had evidently become too costly to schlep wood dozens of kilometres. I mean, they mention 100 kilometres, which is about 62 miles, over very steep terrain. It's very steep terrain in this particular area. And they just costed themselves out of the market, basically, and the mines closed. And something like 30,000 tons of wood had already been used. In one mound, they found evidence of, well, they calculated 4,100 acacia trees and more than 185,000 white broom. And in fact, the area hasn't recovered to today. There is very, very few plants of this kind. The removal of the trees, even so many thousands of years ago, would have changed the water regime in the area. And so there is a lesson in that for all of us. Don't cut down trees for short-term profit, because the results are disastrous and they're long-term.
It's really fascinating. And actually, last time I was out in Timna, I emailed the lead researcher, one of the lead researchers, Professor Erez Bar-Yosef, about how could they have fed the mines? And you're explaining his research very well. Fascinating. Now, this leads us to another story that you just wrote about, which is planting forests in dry lands all over the world is unlikely to help in the fight against global warming and climate change. And this obviously kind of speaks to all of us who have had trees planted through JNF, bat mitzvah trees. And was it all for naught then, Sue?
Well, we're looking here at dry lands, which is more kind of deserty areas. So the Yatil forest in the Negev, which was planted by JNF, that's more in the direction that this research is going. We're talking rather than trees in Mediterranean areas. It's a completely different climate. This is joint research by the Weizmann Institute and the Technion, which was just published in Science magazine. The research team included Professor Dan Yakil, who received the Israel Prize for Earth Science. He's been monitoring the Yatil forest for many, many years. And I think the research could have significant ripples across the scientific community. worldwide. You know, we know that many countries, among them China and countries in the Sahel region, are undertaking massive tree planting exercises. China itself has pledged to plant 70 billion trees. And this is because trees absorb CO2. Now, we know that when there's more CO2 in the atmosphere warms. That's why we have global warming. If trees remove CO2, they contribute to cooling. So it's kind of the great white hope, if you like, for one of the great white hopes for helping to tackle global warming and climate change. But it turns out that in dry areas, the benefits are far less clear. And this is because of a phenomenon called the albedo effect. If you think of going out on a very hot day in Israel, you will often put on a white T-shirt rather than a black T-shirt. And that's because a white T-shirt bounces a lot of the sun's rays back into the atmosphere. A black T-shirt absorbs them and then releases the heat. And this is what can happen. It's already happening, actually, in the Arctic. We know that the Arctic and the Antarctic are warming much faster than other parts of the globe. And that's partly because as the snow melts, the snow is white, the snow and ice, it bounces back the sun's rays. As soon as the snow melts and it reveals tundra, which is a dark colour, you get this additional warming because the colour is absorbing the sun's rays and then releasing the heat. And the same apparently happens when you plant forests, or it can happen when you plant forests in a desert, because suddenly you're getting a dark canopy replacing a light area. And they calculated, I won't go into the calculations because it's complicated, but essentially they showed that it's that in a lot of cases, for example, they looked at the at planting in the Sahel area, and they found that when they looked at dry lands that are available for forestation there, they found that they would have net warming effects after 80 years. So it's complicated. And what they've done is to publish a digital map. And you can find it in the, if you look into my article, you'll see also the connection to the digital map, where they go all over large parts of the world and they show which areas are likely to have the albedo effect outweighing the carbon dioxide absorption effect and which area not, to help decision makers really pinpoint where it's worth planting trees. That is their basic message. Research the area that you're going to plant before you actually do it. But the main way to bring emissions down is probably not going to be through forests, and definitely not through forests in arid areas, but through cutting emissions.
Okay, so this definitely leads us to our next story. And you interviewed a woman called Violeta Ryabko, who just 4 months ago arrived in Israel from Russia, correct?
Correct.
She was the former Greenpeace media director there. And she has written a brochure for Israelis on ways to reduce plastic waste, and I would assume emissions in a way, over the high holidays. So tell us a little bit about what she suggests.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic for a new immigrant who came, I mean, without Hebrew. She was working at Greenpeace Russia for many years, and she developed a passion and actually wrote a book on zero waste. So Violeta, who is 34, has been doing an internship at Greenpeace Israel, where she suggested and wrote the text for this brochure, How to Cut Waste on the Holy Days, which I think is very cool after just 4 months of being in the country. It's being published, it's online in English, Hebrew, Russian and Arabic. Apparently it's been making waves already in the Russian community. And she explains, you know, why plastic is bad, why it's bad for the environment, why it's bad for our health. And then she gives five very, very simple ways to cut plastic on the holidays, which are: when you go to the supermarket, take a reusable bag. Don't use plastic bags. Use jugs for your soft drinks rather than buying plastic bottles. Don't use plastic straws, and we know how fatal they can be for wildlife. Use real cutlery and crockery and wash it in the dishwasher rather than plastic, single-use plastic. And create your own decorations for the sukkah. Don't use balloons. Don't use things that are not going to that are not biodegradable. So these things are all incredibly simple for us to do, and you know, could have a nice effect on cutting down our plastic.
I love it. Okay, thank you, both of you, for joining me today. Tal, Sue, thanks so much, and have great days, both of you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing, and thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
And be sure to check out our weekly feature, Times Will Tell, released every Friday. Until next time,
Shalom.